Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to share a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Deacon Matt Halbach. He's a Catholic revert, and he's now the president and publisher of Franciscan Media. And you can find out more information at franciscanmedia.org. But we're really honored to have him here tonight to share his story of how he came home to the Catholic Church in the year 2000. Right. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for having you. We've got a great story lined up for us tonight, a little different than usual. You were a revert to the Catholic Church, so you were born Catholic.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's go back and start there and tell us a little bit about that background.
Sure. I'll appreciate being on the show. And I think a lot of young Catholics are going to resonate with this story and even into young adulthood, because that's the age range in which a lot of this discernment and conversion takes or reversion takes place. And I'll just start by saying I had a very typical, what I would think is a very typical Catholic childhood, meaning as a young person, parents went to Mass pretty frequently, would go with them, was put in religious education at the parish, and you know, and the education at the time was what it was, and I don't fault any catechist for, you know, sometimes today we look back and say, boy, we wish catechist did X, Y, Z, or catechesis needs an update and all this. And I was still of the time period where we're using felt boards, if you remember that, about here's the Holy Spirit's a bird and everything. So whatever you can take from that, basically memorizing a lot of lists and facts and figures about religion, but not a lot of it sinking in. And then I remember taking quizzes and exams where, to be frank, if you didn't know the answer and you just said Jesus or love, you're probably right 50% of the time. You know what I mean? It's just this kind of a thing.
Right.
So not
right.
a lot of sinking in of the religious formation and catechesis, which is so critical, as you know, at a very young age. I mean, you and I are both fathers. We have children relatively in the same age range. I've got ages six to 17. Yeah. Catechesis is so crucial. And the crucial piece is that they see the application of that religious formation in their life, like why this matters to them and how to appropriate that.
Right.
So I think that was missing for me during my formation. It was probably typical of a lot of people then and probably typical of a lot of people now.
Yeah.
That's really the first piece there. So it was a typical Catholic upbringing, confirmed in age 14, you know, eighth grade. But then, and really about that, what do I recall? I had a cake.
Yeah,
I remember I stood in a line, I received oil, the bishop said something, and, you know, again, just not really being prepared or really recognizing the gravity of the moment, embracing it, which is, again, is so typical. And you can't force kids to be ready for that either.
Right.
So it's just, it is what it is. And I think it's important to call out, because I think, as we know, that one of the biggest issues facing the church today is young people leaving or young adults leaving. And I think what I've been talking about kind of factors into that.
Right. You might have already mentioned this, but what was you were kind of on the sacramental track on this side, but at home, was the faith talked about much?
Thanks for bringing that up. So, you know, I can't compare our family with other Catholic families. We did oftentimes say grace over meals. I do remember in the early years, sometimes a prayer at night with mom or dad. But it wasn't very, consistent, I think. And that's another important piece. As we know now, as fathers bringing up our children in the faith, we got to pray with it. We got to pray with them. We got to practice it in the home.
Yeah.
And then it just becomes more normal, normalized.
Yeah. I totally empathize with the difficulty of making it consistent,
right.
But there's such a trickle down from fathers. You know, and whether they kind of bring that atmosphere of the faith being the ordering principle, not just one thing among many, but really the ordering principle of our lives. And it's tough.
100%. It's very tough. And you know what? And I think you would agree that just the witness of, for example, my wife and I pray as a deacon, I do the Liturgy of the Hours every day. Mm-hmm. So my wife will pray with me in morning and evening prayer. We invite our kids to do it. They hardly ever join us. But the fact that we're sitting in the living room doing this while they're moving around and going from room to room or eating breakfast or whatever, like that's important.
Yeah.
That sinks in. Mm-hmm. That's them seeing, oh my gosh, their prayer's a part of their regular daily life.
Right.
It's and an for anchor. Good reason.
Yeah.
It's an anchor.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an anchor. So confirmation, you know, kind of just came and went. And then I had probably you know, it's up there in terms of the most traumatic things that can happen in a person's life. especially as a young person. So you had my parents, their relationship was difficult for a long time. Mm-hmm. And without going into a bunch of details, everything sort of came to a head the year after confirmation. So that would be like my ninth grade. And it came to a head, and part of they end up divorcing, and part of the reason for this, and this is intrinsic to the rest of the story, and I asked my dad's permission to tell this part. Part of this is that there was infidelity in the marriage. And so that was a big sore spot, obviously, for my mom. My dad left. He's the one, you know, he divorced and left. I remember when he was telling me the news at this time. And by the way, I have one sibling, Todd, who's 8 years older. He was already in college at the time when this divorce happened. Mm-hmm. And I remember my dad telling me the news, and, you know, I'm crying, and I said, is there anything I can, I said, is this my fault? Like so many kids, right?
Right.
No, it's not your fault. Is there anything I can do, you know, to make you stay? No, this isn't about you. It's about your mom and I, and da, 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 da. I remember then and there, shortly after he left, because when he left. I took all of his stuff. And I remember going into my bedroom and asking the Lord. And I was surprised by this because, again, I'm painting a picture up to that point of, then there's not a lot of engagement
sure.
on a personal level, on a relational level with God. But for some reason, and the reason is God and grace, I get on my knees and I say, Lord, I need you to be like my father now. I need you to guide me. I need you to help, you know, continue to raise me, form me, just kind of show me the way. And that's what really the rest of this story of eventual leaving the church and coming back to the church, it's going to be marked with people that God has put in my life to help show the way and show his continued fatherhood. So let's go back to the divorce and the announcement and the infidelity. So then because of all of this, my mom just says, I'm done with the faith. I'm done going to church. Mm. And her reasoning was, I mean, it's an emotional reasoning. How could God allow this? You know,
right?
Why is this happening? Where is he? And then, of course, they start thinking, or she starts thinking as a parent, as a Catholic, like, we go to Mass and, you know, we say prayers sometimes and we do this. And almost like, this should not happen because we, you know, we're trying to practice the faith.
Right, right.
So for 2 years, I wasn't going to church with her. And at the same time, I had made that plea to God to be my father.
Right.
And, you know, take over that role. 2 years pass, and then I guess I'd be about 17 or 18 at this point, and it's Divine Mercy Sunday. And my mom didn't know at the time that it was Divine. I didn't either. But looking back, we figured this all out.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the priest is preaching about mercy and the importance of mercy. Well, at this particular Mass is the other woman that was involved in this infidelity. And I remember after the Mass, now my mom's an Italian and she's a passionate Italian. She talks through hands and she's very just dynamic. And this is obviously a deep, deep, deep wound. But she sees the other woman there and she gets up after Mass and she makes a beeline over to her. And I'm thinking, oh, my Lord. At the time, by the way, this dates me, but at the time, the show Jerry Springer was super popular.
Right.
And in that show, the people, the audience would throw chairs and get into fights. I'm like, this could happen here at our church. You know, I mean, this is what we could be facing. I watch the two of them talk and I can't hear what they're saying. And then after a minute or so, the other woman just sort of dissolves into tears and she throws her arms around my mom. And my mom's kind of holding her up. And then they just kind of part ways. And my mom comes back and I say, Mom, what happened? She said, well, I had to forgive her. I said, why? And this is a son who's wants to defend his mom. And, you know, why would you forgive her? And she gave me two reasons that I'll never forget. And these are important reasons later. One, she says, I had to forgive her for myself because the pain of this divorce and the pain of all this has been too much and I felt shackled by it. It's been killing me, is what she said. But the other reason is, and this is so Christ-like and so unforgettable, she said, I thought that if I were her, I would need to be forgiven in order to move on.
Oh, boy. Wow.
That's so empathetic.
Incredible. Yeah.
That's so Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Jesus is empathy incarnate.
Had she been kind of thinking and praying through this stuff while you were away from the church?
So while we were away, she went to counseling. She's trying to reflect and meditate. We had lots of conversations. She's just trying to rebuild. And there was still some prayer there. I mean, it's not like God was gone. It's just that she really, frankly, the reason she didn't want to go back to that church was that woman was there. Mm. She was part of the congregation. Yeah. But that ends up like setting up a more of a pathology for me later. Just, well, do I really need to go to church, you know, and what does it matter? And which we'll talk about. But
sure.
but that
beautiful moment.
Beautiful
sure.
moment yeah. is a moment that will later I will circle back to and say, God is real, the church is real, I need to be with God in the church. Mm-hmm. And so that's really was a catalyzing moment for me to at least continue to work with God, have a relationship with God, continue to wait for God to answer that prayer, be my father, you know. From there, we go to college, a typical college experience. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I could resonate or reverberate with Augustine, St. Augustine, on in his confessions is when he says, give me chastity, Lord, but not just yet.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the mindset of a typical college kid who's exploring all these things. Mm-hmm. And there's a selfishness there and an egoism and a lustfulness and things like that. But also present at college for me was the challenge of taking courses in philosophy for the mm-hmm. first time.
And where was this at?
University of Iowa.
Okay.
In philosophy for the first time, in religion. And again, not having a strong previous catechetical background, that's why I keep mentioning this, mm-hmm. and then being faced with these courses in college, it just, your head gets put on a swivel,
sure.
like if you're not prepared. And just like we're trying to prepare our kids for when some of them go on to college, to be rooted in their faith and understand their faith and understand how their faith applies. But boy, you're now exposed to all these questions about, there's more than one. Is there more than one God? Do all roads point to the same God? You know, all sorts of isms that we explore in philosophy. And that, I think, it, for that age and for me, set me on a kind of confirmed, I don't think I need to go to church. And, you know, I haven't been going, and I don't think I need to go. I can find God anywhere. That sort of a thing. And it's unfortunate because the reality was, which I didn't want to see at the time, that being plugged into the church was supportive of my prayer life, and my prayer life ultimately leads me, or should, to the church and to fellowship. Mm-hmm. You can't have, in my opinion, looking back, you can't have just one or the other. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to say, I can just have my relationship with God. I don't need this community over here. I don't need these teachings over here. I can just have my life for my relationship with God. This period of my life, very malleable, and I took a job, and this is so God. I took a job at Starbucks, which isn't exactly a conservative, you know, traditional values-minded company, but at the time, that's not where I was anyway. So I took this job at Starbucks, and I was put alongside a guy named Joshua. Now, we know in the Hebrew, Yeshua is another name for Jesus. And so Joshua was a convert to the Catholic faith. Joshua came from a Southern Baptist upbringing, and he had no problem talking about his faith, sharing it, being dynamic about it, very convincing about it. And he's the kind of guy that would, you know, the little mass market copies of the catechism. He got one from Barnes & Noble, and he'd have it there at his register. He'd be reading through it, and he'd read something, and it seemed like, and this is where I'm saying it's the Holy Spirit looking back on all this, I always got assigned to work next to him, at the register next to him, this is going to be one of the first people, my mom being the first, who was a witness of God's love and mercy and that beautiful forgiveness of the other woman. Joshua is going to be the next person in this story of people who God puts in my path to guide me back home. Mm-hmm. Joshua, I remember one day he comes across this Eucharistic teaching and he's like, Matt, you're Catholic, right? And I'm like, well, not really. And yes, because what do you mean? I haven't gone to church in a long time. He's like, oh, well, do you know about the Eucharist? And I'm like, yeah, it's the bread of life. Or I said something like, yeah, it's whatever. He goes, this is really the body and blood of Jesus. And I said, yeah. Like, yeah, I remember being told that back then, you know, right. Like in fifth grade. He's like, do you understand that? Do you believe that? And I'm like, I think I understand it. I mean, I don't know. He goes, oh my gosh. And he's like, you could see in his face, mm-hmm. one, he was like highly, seemed like disappointed, which I don't blame him. I was like, this is what Catholics are like. But two, he's like, you could see he just like became mission minded mm-hmm. in this moment. And I became his project. And this is what's going to happen. and he says, okay, when was the last time you went to Mass? I said, it's been years. He goes, okay, well, I'd like to take you. And I thought, like, thinking back on this, I'm like, it's not a bold gesture. It is and it isn't. Like, right, you got to put yourself out there mm-hmm. to say, I'm going to invite you to church or back to church in this case. But it's not a lot to just invite somebody. Like, the words that are spoken, it's not a huge thing. But it is an intention. It's a big intention.
Yeah.
So he's like, I'd like to invite you. And I said, okay. He goes, the next Mass is Monday, 7 a.m., St. Wenceslas, in Iowa City. I'm like, 7 a.m.? Like, I didn't even know they had Masses at that time, mm-hmm. and daily Mass for that matter. And he could see I was wavering and kind of losing interest. He goes, what if I throw in breakfast? So shrewd also, right? And it reminds me of Jesus when he says to his apostles, be as wise as serpents and gentle as doves. Right. That was Joshua,
yeah,
to a T. So Monday rolls around. We get in his car, we go to St. Wenceslas, and I pay attention to Mass in a way that I hadn't for years. And I think the reason being was that this guy went out of his way to invite me. Mm-hmm. And that generosity and thoughtfulness sparked this.
We ask you a good question, too.
It's a great...
Right, like about the Eucharist.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
that's so... Yeah,
you
talk about
this?
Random.
Did you believe this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Those are hard questions,
those are
man.
Very hard questions, right? And he's like already like a Catholic evangelist. Mm-hmm. And I think, honestly, he had just come into the church like that year. So he's on fire, yeah. Right? And that fire was burning brightly. So we go to church. I pay attention. And I remember at the elevation of the chalice, which will later be significant because eventually I became a deacon. Deacons are ministers of the chalice. Mm-hmm. At the elevation of the chalice, my focus was really captured. And I kind of remember my mouth being open for some reason, and I was just staring. And I felt like something wonderful was being communicated, although I wasn't sure what it all was. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew from a Catholic upbringing the significance of what's taking place, but it seemed like that significance was deepened mm-hmm. inside of me. In that moment. After the Mass, Joshua introduced me to the pastor, who at the time was Father Mike Phillips, who has since been a lifelong friend, 20 plus years. And he factors into this story in a couple ways. We named our first kid after him. He married mm-hmm. Stacy and I. But anyway, he introduced me to Father Mike, and we go off to breakfast. Well, I'm thinking we're going to go to like Denny's, Perkins, someplace like that. Yeah. He goes into a residential neighborhood and pulls into somebody's driveway. And I'm like, Joshua, where are we going? And he goes, oh, we're going to breakfast. And this woman comes out of her house. She has an apron on. She has this Austrian, I found out later she was Austrian, German-Austrian accent. And she's like, oh, Joshua, come on in. Come on in. Is this your friend? Oh, wonderful. Come on in. Breakfast is ready. And I'm like, what is happening? And I go in, and immediately her name is Inga. What I don't know is that she runs the only Catholic bookstore in town. And she hands me a Bible. She hands me a catechism. She hands me a copy of something about the saints. And we sit down to breakfast. And not like 5 minutes in to the meal, another bold question, just like Joshua, you know, do you believe this? Inga goes, Matt, when was the last time, or Joshua told me you haven't been to church in a long time, is what she says. Then she says, when was the, you're talking, this is so bold. When was the last time you went to confession? Can you imagine asking a stranger that?
Yeah.
And I felt, I'm surprised looking back that I was cooperating with all this. And again, it's the Holy Spirit, obviously, but it's like, what a bold question. But I said, I don't know, like 8 years. And she goes, and this is back in the day when you had those phones that, you know, you had the antenna, and she hits one button. So it's a speed dial. And she calls up the pastor at St. Wenceslas, whom we just left.
We just met.
Right? Oh, Father Mike, this is Inga. I'm sitting with this guy, young guy, and he hasn't been to confession in 8 years. So I'm going to drive him over shortly to the rectory. And you can hear him go, what? What's going on? And then she hangs up the phone. And we finish our meal, and she drives me over there, and I go along with this. Again, it's like, this is the most insane thing. It's like you're on a ride. It's like a roller coaster ride, and you know you're not in control now, and you just go with it. It's like you jump into a current, and you're just letting the current take you. That to me is the hallmark of the Holy Spirit, not to mention all the fruits thereof, but... At any rate, we go back to the rectory. Father Mike's going to kill me for saying this part, but we go back to the rectory. I knock on his door. He peers through the Venetian blinds, and he looks at me. He doesn't quite remember who I was, so he just puts the blinds back and doesn't open the door. So then I knock again, and he opens the door, and he goes, I'm sorry, we don't have any money. He closes the door. And this sounds so biblical, like, oh, I knocked three times, but I knocked three times. And the third time he goes, what is it? What can I do for you? I said, and Inga's still parked out front. And she's like, this is the guy I was talking about. I was like, oh, all right, come on in. All right, what's going on? And I said, I haven't gone to confession in like 8 years. I haven't been in the church in a long time. This mass this morning was the first mass in several years. And he goes, wow, well, let's talk. And the fact that I don't know what his schedule was for that day, but that he just said, let's talk. And he ended up, we probably spent two and a half hours. Not to say I had 2.5 hours worth of sins to share, but just simply to say, we explored, you know, where was God in my life? How has God led me up to this moment? You know, does God love me and all these things? And the answer is absolutely yes, yes, yes. I got to take a pause real quick because I got out of sequence on something that's critical. So as I said, in college, just having that typical experience of what's true, what's real, and trying to keep this relationship with God going, but not feeling like I need to have a relationship with God in the church. I was also dealing with a lot of anxiety and depression, which is very common today too, especially among young people. And I think a lot of that just started with the divorce, but for whatever reason, it just got worse and worse. I'd been through therapy, counseling, medications before. And it was my sophomore, junior year in college that I just kind of hit the lowest point where nothing was working. I couldn't leave my dorm room. If I did, I'd get sick, like physically. Felt very chained and confined, you know, like a prisoner. Yeah. And just going through that for so long, eventually one of two things happen. You come out of it with the help that you need, or another scenario is you commit suicide. And at that point in my life, there was a desire for that, to just end things. And so what happened was, and this is back, we were talking earlier before the show about dating ourselves. This is back with MP3 players, which is significant. I took a walk about 2 a.m, not feeling great, obviously, because every time I got out of my dorm room, I'd get sick. But I thought, well, I'm going to figure out how I'm going to end my life. And I start this walk, and there's a bridge in Iowa City over the Iowa River between my dorm, Burge, and then Voxman Music Hall. And at the middle of this bridge, as I walked through up it, and I never noticed it before, there's a plaque there that said, so-and-so jumped from here in 1985. And that's when it clicks, like, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm listening to my headphones at the time, and I'd not had, like, a real... like epiphany moment or a real strong personal encounter with God up to this point. But as I get over the edge of the bridge, like I'm straddling it, this is early in the morning, the sun starts to come over the horizon. And so all this light starts to flood in. And on my headphones, which is set to random, the song Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles comes on. I mean, I'm still a huge Beatles fan. And I look at that sun, I hear this, and for the first time in my life, and again, I go back to that prayer as a young person, be my father,
right.
Show me the way. I felt like it was the Father's response. You know, stop, for one. And for two, I've got work for you. I need you. Because I remember saying to God in that moment, I probably, based on how I was living, I probably deserve to go to hell. You know, if you keep me around, if you have a plan for me, as I'm thinking about all this and the grace of this moment with the sun and the music and everything else, I want to spend the rest of my life trying to help people not get into this situation. Like people who deal, not just who deal with anxiety and depression, but help people find you if you're real. And that was one of the first kind of like, I'm here. I got you.
Yeah.
Then after that, that's when I started working at Starbucks.
Okay. That's incredible, Matt. So all that happened, yep. And then you end up at Starbucks, you have these crazy experiences with Joshua and Inga, and there you are talking to Father, and so you're sharing this with him. So there's a lot coming out in that conversation. That's incredible. Let's take a break there, and then we'll come back to that conversation and see what came out and what followed from that crazy providential meeting and conversations that you had there, man. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Deacon Matt's story, so stay tuned for that. If you go to chnetwork.org, you'll find a whole archive of stories from all different backgrounds. And so whatever background or history you're coming from, again, whether it's from a Protestant tradition or a non-Christian tradition, or even dealing with, as Matt has shared, mental health, emotional health issues, wherever you are in your journey, you'll find someone who comes from a similar background who has come to encounter Christ and has come home to his Catholic Church. And I would bet that their story would have a lot for you to think and pray about. So check that out at chnetwork.org. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Matt's story. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Deacon Matt Halbach. He's a Catholic revert, and he's now the president and publisher of Franciscan Media. And we'll talk more about that in a moment here. But when we left off, Matt, you were relaying this, this what you said during the break, this Catholic ambush that happened to you.
Right. I mean, I did not expect going to another person's house for breakfast and being given scripture and catechism and lives of the saints. And I certainly didn't expect anyone asking me when was the last time I went to confession. And I think, you know, it's funny, during the break, the producer's like, I'm surprised you went along with that. I am too. I absolutely am. And the only response I can give to that is that it's grace. And I think, you know, grace helps us do some supernatural things. And I think to just sort of go along in that moment is definitely that's not me. If you knew anything about my personality, I'm not like, let me be so self-disclosing and transparent about all things, you know, so.
Well, when we left off again, you'd also shared this experience that had happened right before this, you know, of contemplating suicide and having this moment where God, again, in his providence, you know, showed up and showed you his love. Was this maybe when you're now fast forwarding ahead, talking to this priest, was this the first time you'd sort of been able to open up and share anything about that?
Yes, 100%.
Okay, tell us more about that conversation.
Yeah, 100%. So that experience on the bridge is where I first did what I would have loved to have done much earlier on in my life, which is put together, like have that personal encounter with God and be able to see that the faith applied and part of that faith applied on that bridge, there is an interpretive piece to it, which is, you know, the song plays, Here Comes the sun comes up, but you still have to interpret through the lens of faith that this could be a God moment, right? And so with that happening now, there's much more of a conviction that God is involved. God's going to continue to keep to answer my plea, that he fathers me, shepherds me. And as we're seeing, he's putting people in my life to do this, ultimately to get me back into the church and then serving the church. So that conversation with Father Mike was a lot about what I just said. Is I talked about the divorce, I talked to him about the pain of it, I talked to him about the plea, and he we worked through all that together, and he's the one who tried to help me interpret it, saying, see, this is where God's led you now to this point. This is how all that stuff in the past and the pain and the loss of your dad and all these other things, this led to this moment. And to have someone to help guide you through that is, I think for most people, probably necessary. Because again, you can have the faith, but we need help sometimes interpreting life through that lens of faith. And Father Mike was there at that moment to help me do that. And he would become then a critical piece of my discernment to just come back into the church and make Eucharist, confession, Catholic life a regular practice, and then eventually contemplate serving the church. And he was the one. It was shortly thereafter, probably a year or so transpired. I just graduated from the University of Iowa at this point, and he was inviting me to come and serve Mass. He was inviting me to come and participate in RCIA, and I was just reading and reading and reading. Why? Because I became best friends with Inga, if you remember her, who owns the Mustard Seed, the Catholic bookstore in town.
Joshua was friends with her. Okay.
And when he converted, he converted at St. Wenceslaus, and she and her husband, Carl, were parishioners there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's how all that came to be. And everyone asked me, too, when I tell this story, what happened to Joshua. I don't know. I know he went into the military, and I don't know. We lost touch. So it's like he comes into my life. And
Joshua, if you're out there, send us a note.
I would love that. Please. Yes. I've wondered for 25 years, you know, what's happened. But at any rate, so Father Mike would help me, you know, bring me more into like the work around the church and ministering in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another critical piece that was important to coming back to the church, was finding your place in it. Mm-hmm. You know, what gifts do you have? Do you have anything to offer? Of course, everyone does. But I don't know how many Catholics think about that. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of Catholics, unfortunately, find themselves or consider themselves to be spectators. And God has a plan for them. God has given them gifts to use, and they need to discern with God what those are and use them. And I think at that moment, you know, post-college, that was probably the best way to get me really grafted up back into the church, is through service of some kind.
Right.
So it was altar service, RCIA, as I said. And then after about a year, Father Mike's like, would you ever consider being a priest? And I mean, I said, well, obviously by this point, I trust this guy implicitly. He's such a spiritual companion. So I said, do you think I could be one? Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, I don't know, but let's find out. And he said, I know you like to study theology. You've been reading these books voraciously at the Mustard Seed. Would you be interested in going on for more education? Because you're going to need that if you're going to do some more ministry in the church. And I said, okay, so guess where he sends me, where he recommends? Franciscan University in Steubenville, which I had no idea what that was or what they're about or anything like that. But if he was recommending it, all right. And so I've got so many stories about Franciscan University. But to keep all this in relation to the journey back in and the journey now of serving the church, finding a place in the church, there was a pivotal time. This is another big story. So I'd been discerning the priesthood. They had a pre-theologate there at Franciscan. But there was still a lot of anxiety about, what does God want me to do? Okay, you've got me back in the church, but what am I supposed to do with my life? How do I serve you? What gifts do I have? And there was so much angst around that for some reason. And the more I thought about myself as a priest, there wasn't a lot of comfort there or peace, which is another hallmark I look for, you know, in my discernment. Yeah. Then one day, this is another story, probably late February. Are you familiar with Steubenville, the city?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So there's two cemeteries in town. There's a Catholic cemetery and a public cemetery. So I decided to pray a rosary. And now this is where God gifts me with a personal relationship with Mary, who's going to be another guide, right, to help me live in my home and serve my home, the Catholic Church. And I remember praying my rosary, asking for clarity about, what do you want me to do? Should I be a priest or not? Well, I'm walking through the public cemetery, which is huge, and I've never been there before. As I'm thumbing through the beads, as they say, it starts to snow. Snow covers the ground. You can't, if you get out in the middle of this place, you can't see the perimeter. You can get lost easily. I got lost, and the snow was all over the place. So now I'm going under a tree to just take some shelter. As I'm going through the beads, I look up and I see probably 20 yards from me over here, some bare branches, but like two, I didn't have my glasses on, two blue smudges or things sticking out of the branches. So I decided to go investigate. I go over there and look, and it's two blue artificial roses that someone had just stuck up there. There's no like gravestones or markers anywhere, but they're just there sitting up in these branches of the tree. And I remember grabbing a rose. And as soon as I did that, I grabbed it, said, part of me wanted to believe this was a sign, right, of discernment. This is my old Catholic upbringing where I learned, hey, Mary's favorite color is blue. So my religious imagination's reeling. Hey, it's a blue rose. Maybe this is a sign. She's answering a prayer. Or Christ through is answering a prayer. And as soon as I grabbed this rose, it's just like in the movies. There's like a little demon and a little angel, and the angel's like, this is a sign. This is a sign. And the demon's like, how could this possibly be a sign? And the worst question, and I think a lot of Catholics have heard this whispered in their ear, who are you to get a sign?
Yeah.
Right? Why would God give one to you? Like this idea of, that you have to be exceptional mm-hmm. in some way, in order for God to relate to you in a powerful way, yeah. which is not true. And so he just flicked that off at the time, and I carry my little rose, and I walk around the cemetery, just trying to get back to the parking lot. And this is the second time, right? I had the bridge experience with God. Now it's this experience in the cemetery of being led. And I would say with Inga and Joshua, too, that whole thing was that Catholic ambush and being led through that. So I come, maybe 100 yards I walk, and then I feel kind of compelled to just stop where I am. And this is a public cemetery, and the snow has covered all the grave markers. And something inside just says, brush the snow off this one. So I brush it off. And it's an engravement. It's obviously the name of someone who's deceased, but then there's a beautiful engraving of St. Therese of Lisieux. So now my Catholic imagination is reeling further and like, well, I learned back then that if you pray to Therese then and those prayers are answered, you might get a rose in some way, shape, or form. So now I'm holding this blue rose and thinking all this stuff. And I'm walking along further. And this is the God's honest truth, okay? I'm not going to tell you a lie. Out of the woods come three deer. And they come up to me. And I think what's funny is I used to work for a Sadler, which is a publishing company in New York, in Manhattan. And I was like one of their few employees that wasn't on the East Coast. And sometimes there's like stereotypes about Midwesterners. And anyway, I think everyone thought I knew everything about like hunting and fishing and farming. I don't know any of those things, even though I grew up around farms sure. and wildlife. But I'm bringing that up because as these deer come out of the woods, they come walking towards me to where you are. And now I'm facing these three deer holding this rosary and I'm freaked out. And I don't know what to do because in my imagination, having no survival skills or wilderness knowledge whatsoever, I'm like, are these deer going to like attack me? Are they going to, can they hoof you or like lose your antler somehow? Like what are these, like, do I need to be worried at this point? And this is so embarrassing to tell, which is why you have to believe it's true. I took my rosary and like held it up like a shield. And I go, this is Our Lady's rosary. She's queen of heaven and earth and she loves you. I literally said that. And honest to God, these deer, they kind of bow their head and they turn around and they walk out and I follow them. And then they walk right out to the parking lot to my car. So I get in my car. I drive away. I call my friend and I say, Carolyn, you won't believe what happened at the cemetery today. Da, 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 da. And she said, well, you won't believe that I just finished a novena to St. Therese for you today.
Holy cow.
And
deer, holy deer.
Yeah. And I said, oh my gosh. So the next day I took her back because there was two roses in the branches and she's the one who did the novena. So I took her back to take the other rose. The discernment again was the whole purpose of that rosary experience, and how can I serve this church that I'm in? And if you want to fast forward from that time in the cemetery to 7 years, literally 7 years from that point is when I ended up getting married and deciding not to be in the seminary. Wow. And where we got married is significant. So I met my wife in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
This is after you'd gone through Franciscan?
Yep. So I graduated. I did my MA there.
Okay.
But I did not go on, you know, through in their pre-theologate.
Right.
That.
Right.
So I moved down to Tulsa, and why did I move down there? This is important too. My father, probably 3 or 4 years after the divorce, moved down to Tulsa to take care of my grandma, who suffered a long bout with Alzheimer's. Mm. I just want to say too, as a really important postscript about my dad, a terrific man who has found his faith. He has a wonderful family with two kids. I got a brother and sister with him and his wife, Jane. They're wonderful people. They keep the faith at the center of their lives. It's just, you know, God draws straight with crooked lines.
Yeah.
You know, it's beautiful to see that. We all are crooked lines in different ways.
Yeah.
But I came down to try to Tulsa to also try to foster a relationship with him at that point, to reconnect. Because in God's plan for coming home, it wasn't just come home to the Catholic Church. It's let's repair this home.
That's right.
That was severed. And so in doing so, I signed up for this traveling vacation Bible. That's what I call it. The traveling vacation Bible school called Totus Tuus, JP2.
Yeah.
Right.
Great program.
Yeah. Great program. And at this time, I've not married. And at this time is when the final thoughts of priesthood will be eschewed. So the bishop down in Tulsa, I told him I was still kind of contemplating priesthood and whatnot. He's like, well, why don't you, before we do anything official, why don't you go on this Totus Tuus experience? It'll be great for your discernment.
You were teaching. You were putting on events.
Yes.
Yeah.
Totus Tuus, K-12, catechizing. You're in young adult groups. You spend a summer doing this, and you go from like parish to parish. And,
yeah.
You know, there's host families and things like that. But I saw, you know, as soon as I signed up in the training program, I saw who would eventually be my wife, Stacy, and we just clicked. And we started sharing about our lives. I started telling her about all this stuff that I'm telling you. And the discernment that summer was, maybe God's calling me in this direction, which still doesn't answer fully how am I serving the church, although it does in the sense that marriage vocations absolutely serve the church. It's a sacrament of service. And I remember that summer we were not in the same group, but we would call each other. We would write each other letters or emails. And by the end of that summer, both of us had discerned, because I think she at the time was thinking religious life, or at least had that on her radar. And we both said, maybe God's doing something here. So this is yet another experience of just kind of jumping into the current, feeling pushed in this direction. Okay, let's do that. And what's so funny about this is when I told, because again, I had talked to the bishop down in Tulsa, who at the time was Bishop Slattery, Edward Slattery, of fond memory. His right-hand man, a Monsignor Brankin, who I didn't know they were connected. It was his parish that I was at Totus Tuus where I decided to say, I'm not gonna pursue priesthood anymore. So I told him. He goes, well, why not? I said, well, I met this girl and I want to see what God does with that. He goes, well, I'll tell the bishop then. I'll tell him tonight that you're not gonna enter seminary, blah, 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 blah. Turns out, too, that there's a triangle of relationships that's Monsignor, Bishop, and Stacy, my wife's dad, who's at the time in deacon formation down in Tulsa. They're all good friends. So by the time we make this casual decision. All of a sudden, Stacy's dad knows about it. Stacy's dad, Joe, calls her up and says, "What are you doing? This guy was thinking about priesthood, and you know, now you're taking him away." And I mean, all this stuff. It was so ridiculous. But what's really funny is that Bishop Slattery said, "Well, you know, I know you were discerning this, and this is what it's all about, and you're not going to be a priest, and you couldn't have picked a better person than Stacy. But you owe me your firstborn son," is literally what he says. And I promise, when she was in labor at the hospital at St. Francis, Bishop shows up. And I looked over to Stacy. I'm like, this guy was serious. And he just showed up to offer a blessing. Like, he didn't know, like, kind of where things were at that time in the birth and everything. But he comes in, he just kind of offers a quick blessing and then leaves, you know. So that connection is important because, as I said earlier, if marriage is where we ended up, and I'll say a bit about diaconate shortly, but going from discerning in that cemetery, what should I do? And then fast forwarding that 7 years to marriage with Stacy, we got married in Collinsville, Oklahoma, which is just maybe an hour or 45 minutes north of Tulsa, at a little shrine to St. Therese there. Wow. And it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. And I remember so vividly standing at the altar watching Stacy and her dad walk down. And all of those memories of the cemetery and all those prayers and weird experiences with the deer and everything else came flooding back. And it was like Mary saying to me, ta-da, like, you wanted help, you wanted guidance, you wanted discernment, you wanted to know where the Father is calling you. It's to marriage. And that became that anchoring sacrament. And that became that's the way I'm going to relate to this church primarily, right? In that sacrament of service. The call to the diaconate is much later, but go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Well, just, Sorry. Yeah, so we have about 7 minutes left. Yeah, so...
Oh!
Yes, tell us about the diaconate.
So with the diaconate, it was really Joe, Stacy's father, who became another figure that, again, going back to that plea as a child, be my father, help me find my way. Mm-hmm. He becomes another person like Father Mike, you know, like my mom, like Mary and Therese, like my wife. And he says, he just offers this beautiful example of diaconate, blending marriage and ministry. Being a spiritual leader in the home, being a spiritual leader in your parish and in the wider community, that's really the impetus and drive for becoming the deacon. I think a lot of people think, well, especially if there's a seminary story somewhere in there, they're like, oh, well, you became a deacon by default, didn't you? And it's like, no, it's something that you discerned. It's a totally different call. And it was definitely her father that was the catalyst for all of that, for sure. And, with the diaconate, what am I doing now? I've been ordained 6 years for the Diocese of Des Moines. I'm their director of deacon formation. I've been involved in deliverance ministry as well, which is something else. That's not something you just kind of... You definitely need to discern if you're going to be involved in that.
Right?
And other people need to be discerning with you. But I'll share one more story since we're here to tell stories.
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things, and this actually goes back to my time in Steubenville. So now we're rewinding the tape, and who says that anymore, right? When we deal in our digital age. But let's rewind the tape. Let's rewind the tape a little bit. We'll go back to Steubenville one last time, where I had a wonderful friend, Carolyn, I mentioned about the cemetery. Well, she had a friend named Linda who took a fall, a nasty spill down the steps. Carolyn doesn't drive. Linda needed to go to the hospital. So I took Linda. And in the lobby or whatever, I'm filling out Linda's paperwork. And Linda casually leans over and says, "Did I ever tell you that I had an exorcism performed on me? Do you expect this to happen? Do you expect deer to come out of the woods? Do you expect all these weird things to happen that have happened? No, but this is what's happening." I said, "I would have remembered if you told me that," something like that. I knew Linda a little bit through Carolyn. She says, yeah. And apparently the background real quick was that she had been in this cult and all of this bad stuff going on, and that the exorcism was actually done by Father Mike Scanlon.
Oh, wow.
So this took place back in Steubenville when he was still there. So I'm like, no, that's incredible. Oh, my gosh, what was that like? Da, 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 da. Well, we take her into the triage room, and she gets hooked up, and they're trying to figure out what's wrong with her. Someone comes in that's, like, missing this part of their arm and just screaming, and Linda wakes up. And Linda is all agitated by this, and she starts to believe that the evil one is after her, like, in this moment. Now, having her said just what she's just said in the lobby, now there's some gravitas to this, and it's quite disturbing. And she tries to get her clothes together. She's just all, you know, just beside herself. I tell her she needs to stay where she is. She can't go anywhere. The doctor hasn't seen her yet. And I tell her not to leave like two or three times. The third time, she turns around and looks at me, and then her eyes go all white, and her voice goes way down, and she goes, "Get the," and I won't say it, "out of my way." And then she just bolts past me and runs down the hallway in the hospital. This is at a Trinity East, I think, is what the hospital was in Steubenville. Mm-hmm. And it hangs a left. And I go chasing after her. This is all relevant, by the way. And I go chasing after her. And I turn a corner, and there's like a 4-foot-tall nun in a black habit with rosary beads who's like holding Linda up and patting her on her back. And I'm like, what? Where'd this person come from? What's going on here? And she gets Linda sat down, and the nun comes over to me, and she grabs my hands, and her eyes look so youthful, and she had these deep inset wrinkles. And she's like, already knows the situation. And she says to me, she'll be okay. Sometimes the evil one just tries to scare us. And I'm like, who are you? Like, what? And then she just turns around and leaves and walks another way. And then around the corner comes the orderly and the nurse, and like, what's going on? And we get Linda back in her room. And I said to the nurse, you know, thank God that nun was there. And she goes, well, what nun? I said, there was a nun there that helped out. And she went the opposite direction and turned the corner. Well, what did she look like? I said, she had black on, and basically it was the habit of the TORs. Mm-hmm. And she goes, oh, we haven't had TOR sisters here in like 50 years. And I'm like, what? Like, this is all wild stuff. But anyway, that, and there were a couple of other experiences where, in discerning with the exorcist for the Diocese of Des Moines, he's like, I think God might be calling you in this ministry. Right. And in a serious way, meaning, you know, this all sounds like, wow, crazy and phenomenal, but the reality is it pales in the comparison of the power and glory of God.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what I see in deliverance ministry. And mostly what transpires, and I think it's important for people to know, is reconciliation mm-hmm. between persons and the Father. Reconciliation of families takes place in deliverance ministry. Evangelization, reintegration with sacraments and with the believing community, mm-hmm. which is what this program's all about.
Yeah.
And it's serving just, you're doing just such a wonderful apostolate of deliverance for a lot of people. And it's one of the things that attracted me to be on here and to share these crazy, weird stories with you.
Well, Matt, we're out of time. I'm sure you got many more stories. We'll have to do a part 2 sometime.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was thinking, again, thank you for your ministry and for your deliverance ministry and your diaconate and your family. Again, that great sacrament of service. You know, part of your story involved some of the mental health, emotional health
yes.
stuff. And there's a distinction between mm-hmm. the spiritual battle and the mental, emotional health stuff. Like, it is a distinct thing, but they're always also connected.
Yeah.
That's part of your whole journey.
Yeah.
The providence of God, the reality of the spiritual battle, the reality that the devil wants to discourage us and take us away, but the Father is there even mm-hmm. when we're not sure of it, even if we can't always feel it or mm-hmm. see it. And so we do, and this is another point that you made that we should end on here, that we need that community, we need other people to take us back, to remind us that God remains in control, we remain on the journey, the Father loves us, and we just have to not give up. Thank you so much, Matt, for sharing your story, for your ministry. We need to talk about Franciscan Media, but if people go to franciscanmedia.org, they can find out about all the great work done by that apostolate there. And so thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Deacon Matt's story is inspiration to you. We'll be back again next week with another story, but in the meantime, God bless.